I didn't make sheets for you today, I'm sorry, because I was so busy learning up all the stuff that I need to learn to be able to teach this. So I'll tell you, to start off with this class, first of all, I'm going to be doing till the end of the series. So that's the next three classes. So from where we left off, the men of the Great Assembly, through the destruction of the Second Temple, or the beginning of the Roman exile, I'll be taking you on that journey. I want to take you on it carefully and thoughtfully, and it's not an area in which I'm an expert, so I've been spending time learning, and it's something I really wanted both to share with you, because I enjoy this group, and to solidify my own learning. So I have a lot of notes for myself, but I don't have notes for you today, I'm sorry. So I learned a lot from Beryl Wine, so I want to just be thankful to him and his whole tape series in Jewish history, as well as Ken Spiro's series in Jewish history, as well as whatever else I looked up for that. But those are the principal people. Okay, so we left off. With the men of the Great Assembly. So basically, the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, was the group that was founded to swell the ranks of the Sanhedrin, which is the group of 70 sages, the Council of 70, was swelled to 120 after the Persian exile. So the Persian exile is over. They're coming back to the land of Israel. Just to bring you up to speed where we were before, coming back to the land of Israel, rebuilding the Second Temple. If you remember, we left off with that was the end of the Age of Prophecy and the beginning of the Age of Rabbinic Judaism. Does that ring a bell for everybody, basically? Okay. So we have the Second Temple being established and this happening. So the next major thing that happens is the Greeks. So we're going to talk about the coming of the Greeks and the Greek culture and the incredible threat that that was to the Jews. And what was that threat? It's fascinating to think about, and we'll discuss it more at length in the next class when we talk more about Hanukkah and all the dynamics of that. But we talk about four main exiles. The four main exiles are Babylonian, Persian, Greek, and Roman. The Greek exile, which is yet to come in our history, is the only exile that happens inside the land of Israel. So what kind of exile is that? It's a fascinating exile. All the rest were kicked out. That's the typical kind of exile. But the Greek exile's in the land of Israel. So we understand that it was an exile of the mind, not of the body. Right. It was an existential exile. Excellent. And so that's why we light the Hanukkah menorah and shed light where there is darkness. The Greek exile is characterized by darkness. But it was an intellectual darkness. And we fight it as intellectual and spiritual darkness fought by the light of Torah. So we'll get into that more next time. But we want to see the background of what caused that, what brought that about, what was happening for the Greeks. So here's an important principle of assimilation and the Jews. The Jews, of course, our ranks have been depleted by assimilation throughout the ages. And we basically are about the same amount of Jews now as we were during the Roman exile. So whatever we are now, 12 to 14 million, depending on how you count us. But we've always been a tiny speck about the same amount. So we always are losing people to death, destruction, disease, poverty, and assimilation. So we thin our ranks ourselves, and we've always remained a very small people. So what is this threat of assimilation? What is that about? Why didn't we assimilate into Russia? Why didn't we assimilate into Poland?
I would say fear.
Fear, okay, that could be one reason. What else?
We weren't allowed.
Mm-hmm. Why else?
Prophecy.
Prophecy. Hmm? Forced to not assimilate.
Separation.
So there certainly was danger, separation, fear in Germany, and yet there was such a pull to assimilate in Germany, and no pull to assimilate in Russia and Poland. So here's the principle. Jews will assimilate, but only into a higher culture. Only into a culture that's intellectual, that's thoughtful, that looks attractive to the Jew. The Jews are intellectual. The Jews are critical. The Jews are philosophical. They only want to assimilate. They only want to take on. They only want to think about, integrate in, explore something that's interesting to them. So becoming a Russian peasant, not interesting to the Jew. or a Polish peasant, a serf. Not interesting. But a German philosopher, a scientist, a thoughtful a university professor. So that is attractive to the Jews. So that's what's happening with Greece. This is the first major threat to assimilation. We did not really, we got lax in Persia, but we didn't assimilate there. If you think about it, lots of Jews wanted to stay there, and we did talk about how they sent sages into Persia first to set up the infrastructure to receive the exiles. So they wanted to stay there. They were very comfortable there. They had their nice society there. They didn't feel like coming back to the land of Israel and reestablishing the temple, largely, bless you. However, they didn't assimilate into Persia. So the Gemara has lots of insults for the Persians. It calls them hairy bears. And that they ate messy, and they dressed messy, and they had sex messy, and they were just like, they were uncultured, uncouth, uncivilized. They're just not somebody that the Jew wanted to emulate or become a part of in terms of society. We had our own society within their society, but not the Greeks. The Greeks were the fathers of philosophy, but we'll see what the Gemara has to say about that too. But the Greeks certainly developed philosophy. The Greeks had an advanced culture. The Greeks were experimenters. The Greeks were, they had art and theater and poetry and in math they developed geometry to be able to develop the architecture that they wanted. They were all about the intellect and the shining of the intellect, and the Jews thought that was great. Very interested in that. So Hellenism, the whole philosophy of Hellenism, was very attractive to the Jew. And when that was brought to the land of Israel, the Jews flocked towards it. So stop me at any time for questions. Okay, so we're talking about approximately 400 before the Common Era, around in there. Let's see if I'll get close to that. Yeah, around that, in there. So, okay. So we have to understand then a little bit about the Greeks in order to understand why was this so attractive. So this is where my only 2 years of high school education is very revealed. Because I did go to college, but I only had 2 years of high school, and that's where you learn a lot of all that Greco-Roman stuff, right? So I do remember back from those days, but I'm not an expert in it. But looking back at Greece, and I even watched the movie 300 with my kids, but which is interesting that it was called 300. It was a waste of time. But anyway, not for the connecting with the children. That was important. But the actual movie, it's a skip. But anyway, so it turns out, and something that I hadn't really thought about, one of the problems of the Greeks was Greece. And the terrain of Greece, it's mountainous, and it has big rivers, and it was hard to unify as a group. It was hard to make all those. That's why they had city-states, because it wasn't easy from the geographical point of view to unify it into one nation-state. So you had city-states. So all those city-states had their wars against each other, all trying to create some kind of dominance. And you had the Spartans and the Athenians and the Macedonians and all the different city-states that they were, but they struggled between each other. They had civil wars and they struggled for dominance, but they didn't unify. What did unify, though, was a philosophy. So nobody was ruling all of them at once, but they did come up with a common philosophy, the philosophy of Hellenism, that eventually, like what I described a little bit before, that eventually did take over. But in terms of unifying the country, that for 500 years, the Greek tribes fought against each other. So it wasn't until Philip of Macedonia came. Let me just make sure where I am here. I'll back up. It wasn't until Philip that they became unified. So I'll leave that for a second. Okay, so we have the Greeks. They're divided with all their terrain. They have a lack of unity, but they are figuring out things, and they are thinkers. So they have what we would call higher values. They're not necessarily theological values, but they are higher values. And they have an interesting system of paganism that they've developed also, which we'll discuss in just a minute. But first of all, they have these values, and they start to have values that interplay with their system of paganism of thought, and then it develops into art and culture. But it all moves from the philosophy. So the Athenians are thinking, and Athenians, according to the Gemara. So this is the Gemara story, and it doesn't mean that this is the truth. It means there's a thread of truth here. So it could be the truth, but the Gemara we don't see the same way as we see the Torah. The Torah is true. It can be true on many different levels. But Gemara stories can be true or teach a truth in words that aren't necessarily themselves exactly true. So we'll see two different stories here for that. So the Gemara asks, where did the study of philosophy begin? And its answer is King Solomon. So that has to be our answer, right? Because it's our Gemara. So King Solomon. And it may be, I wish I knew more about world history and history of the time. And if anybody knows, please chime in. But more about world history and where philosophy was before King Solomon. What was going on in the world at the time? So I don't know enough about broader world history to comment at all. But we definitely know from our class on King Solomon that he was a philosopher. He was a great thinker. He was considered the wisest of all men. And his wisdom did spill out into the rest of the world. He was recognized by people all around the world as very wise, and people came to him for counsel. So some of the people that came to him for counsel were the wise men of Athens. So the Gemara says 300, I'm thinking about the movie for just a second, says 300 wise men from Athens came. And Rabbi Wein explains that the number 300, whenever the Gemara says 300, it means a lot. It doesn't mean exactly 300. And I'm wondering if that movie 300 also, if like that number just meant a lot, you know, that that was the critical mass.
I do know that that 300 referred to the Spartans. It was a certain, it was a Greek number, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So was it related?
I did research about it. So the 300 referred to the Greeks.
An exacted 300 people.
There, well, not necessarily 300 people, but there was something about the number 300. It was important. It wasn't random. It didn't just mean a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know what it is.
Right. It doesn't just mean a lot. It doesn't just mean a lot, but I'm just wondering, is there a... There's a lot of connection. Right.
Like we talk about certain how many souls were at Sinai.
Mm-hmm. So that was the core 300. Interesting. So I'm wondering if the Gemara reflects that at all, because there's definitely a lot of connection and a lot of influence, a lot of reciprocal influence between Greek culture and Jewish culture, back and forth. So the Gemara says 300 wise people came from Athens to talk to King Solomon. King Solomon plants in them the seeds of philosophy. Jewish philosophy at the point is not highly developed, but philosophy being the study, the logical study of life, what is the meaning of life, right, and trying to apply logic to that. So Rabbi Wein says it's kind of like sleeping in a bed with blankets that are too small. Like wherever you pull it, something is exposed, right? Philosophy doesn't cover. Our human minds can't cover everything in one philosophy. Always something is exposed. And so King Solomon, when he writes his book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, that's a rather pessimistic book, because he really does go through, as the wisest of all men, he does go through many different philosophies, but exposes human frailty, and that this, you could think this, but that doesn't work. You could think this, but that doesn't work. And he shows how you can't make a unified theory of everything. Sorry. So Jewish philosophy is not fully developed at the time. And it's not the key concern at the time to develop an overarching philosophy for the Jews. But he does speak with the Athenians, in a way gives over the seeds of philosophy to the Athenians. They take it back and they develop philosophy. So apparently Socrates is part of that, and Socrates' student is Plato, and Plato's student is Aristotle, right? So we have that line of transmission. But it starts with King Solomon giving over wisdom to Socrates. That's the Jewish story, right? So whatever that means, it certainly does mean that there was a Jewish wisdom that was the underlying current or the underlying seeds for much of Greek philosophy, but just seeds. They fertilized it and grew it and nurtured it on their own. And so it became theirs, right? So, but there were some seeds there. So part of the seeds that were there and part of the thinking that they did then made them look at their own pagan philosophy very critically, and it was difficult to swallow it. So their pagan philosophy was a pretty smart system. The philosophy of the Greeks and the Romans really was, well, we're talking about the Greeks, but you make gods in the image of man rather than man in the image of God, right? So if you make the gods be liars and cheaters and adulterers and thieves and impetuous. So anything that absolves man of sin, right? There can't be a sin because there is no standard that's higher than you that you need to strive towards. The higher ones do all the lower activities of the lower ones, and so therefore the lower ones have nothing to strive towards and do not feel guilty. There is, it's not even they don't feel guilty, there's no, you've headed it off at the pass. There is no sin. There's nothing that you could do that's wrong except for cross a god. But this philosophy allowed the Greek decadence that we're so familiar with from all the movies, right? All the sexuality and immorality and the eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we shall die philosophy. They made homosexuality not just acceptable, but almost a norm. Socrates quotes, Plato quotes Socrates in saying that that's one of the deepest loves, the truest loves, and that it really was brought out as all aspects of the human body of and then their sports were done naked. I mean, it was all, the barriers were just dropped all around for the enjoyment of the physical by human beings. Because that's what the gods are doing, so why not? So it was a philosophy that worked very well for people who have appetites, right? So they really had a philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you'll die. That's a nice way to encapsulate it. Of course, I'm sure there are different parts of it. So what's the difference between that philosophy then and our philosophy now? Our American philosophy.
Well, there's a morality. There's a certain element. There's a great element of morality that has been brought in during the Victorian times and other times to make those things immoral.
Excellent. So even though we have behavior today of eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow you'll die, we feel really guilty about it. Right? So for us, it's eat, drink, and be merry, but the more you eat, drink, and are merry, the more worried you are about dying because you're going to have to pay. Right? So that is a huge difference. So, of course, a philosophy where there isn't guilt, and the Jews already had guilt. They didn't, I don't think, invent the concept. This is a human concept, but the Jews are very good at it. And some of the previous pagans were also pretty good at appeasement and guilt feelings. So the Greeks were all about no guilt at all. You know, not just don't feel guilty, but there was no need. They created a philosophy where there wasn't. There wasn't sin, there wasn't guilt, there wasn't a need to feel bad. You could just move forward and enjoy everything. So that, however, the whole system of gods is a foolish system. And a thinking person who looks at that system is going to understand that it's foolish. And so they did. As they started to develop philosophy, they looked at their own system and said that it's ridiculous. So they started to come up with the concepts of first cause, that there is a God in the world. And that's part of what King Solomon taught to Socrates. There is a God in the world. He made the world. He created it. He started the whole thing. Now, the Greeks ended right there. The Jewish belief is that it goes further than that. But the Greeks came up with this concept, or they called this concept first cause. So they call God the first cause.
First cause?
First cause, yeah. Yeah, so that's based on a philosophic principle that everything has something that causes it. Right, so we know for a fact by looking at this table that somebody made it. Because we know from our experience and from whatever science we've learned that tables don't grow like this, right? Wood grows. People have to cut it. We also know animals didn't make this table, right? People have to cut it. People have to apply skills to it to create this. So we know that it was made by somebody. We know the building was made by somebody. We know the chairs are made by somebody. Just the fact that it exists like that, the way that it's organized, we know for a fact that it was created by somebody. We know for a fact that everybody in this room has parents. Nobody came into the world without a mother and a father. Not possible to be born without both. Even though I've never met your parents, I know for a fact you all have them, right? And so did they. And so did they. And so did they until something had to be first. Something had to be first, right? And so this was how Abraham was. When Abraham, in his world of paganism, came to the concept of God, he went back to something. Something made this, something made that, something made the other thing, but something had to be first. Something had to make the second thing and not have been made. Because otherwise something made that and something made that. But there had to be a first. And that first thing we call God, that thing that existed without being brought into creation, that could bring everything else into being, that's God. The Greeks call that the first cause. But they end off with that characteristic of that being, being first and causing everything to come into being. We don't end off with that. We end off with, or we don't end at all, we continue with, God still intervenes in the world today. So the Greek concept of first causes, God made it, but then let go. Which means that the implications of that philosophy is that God doesn't intervene in the world. It doesn't matter what happens now. We get to run everything. God made it and gave it over. And so now the whole thing is up to human beings to arrange. That's the Greek philosophy. And that's why they thought about different systems of government, too, democracy. The Greek Empire was ruled back and forth by tyranny and extreme democracy. Tyranny and extreme democracy, back and forth. And Socrates and his disciples preached a moderate democracy, understanding that extreme democracy jeopardized the government and tyranny jeopardized the individual. And so they wanted to have a balance of a government that would work, that would respect the individual. And I think it probably hasn't really been until the United States of America that we've been relatively successful with that experiment. It's not the perfect balance. We're still working on it, back and forth. How do we balance government and individual and those rights? But the seeds of that were born in this time of Socrates looking at how tyranny and extreme democracy neither works. And you need something in the middle that will balance the effectiveness of the government and the rights of the individual. So, right. So we have this paganism that doesn't work because now they're understanding that there must be a first cause. And yet they don't believe in intervention, which still allows the paganism to work very nicely. Right? We Jews believe in intervention. We know that God made the world and continues to be active in history, which is why we're constantly talking about the Exodus from Egypt. Right? So the Exodus from Egypt was a major revelation of God's power in the world. No human being was here for the creation. So those 10 edicts that created the world, let there be light, let there be division, let there be earth appearing, there are 10 different let there be's. There's actually 9, technically 9 let there be's. And the in the beginning is considered the first of the 10 statements that the world came into creation through, and each one of them is considered God's display of mastery over a different realm of the world. Each one of the 10 plagues interfaces with one of those 10 statements, so that in the creation of the world and the Exodus from Egypt, the 10 plagues, there was a parallel revelation of God's power over each one of those levels. So there were not, human beings weren't there for the creation, but they were there for the Exodus from Egypt. So that Exodus from Egypt was there and the plagues were there, why Pharaoh's heart was hardened every time. I mean, if you think about it, right? So you have God's favorite people captured by a mean empire, and God wants to get them out. If you're God, how do you get them out? Just take them out. Do you have to get Pharaoh to agree? You know, do you have to get, like, really, you have to get that. I mean, you could freeze the armies, you could make Pharaoh die, you could change his mind. I mean, you want your people out, so take them out. But the whole point of 10 plagues and hardening Pharaoh's heart was to be able to reveal publicly God's power in the eyes of the entire world, particularly for the Jews, but for the entire world. So we constantly are harkening back to that remembrance from the Exodus of Egypt, remembrance from the Exodus of Egypt. I mean, it's throughout our prayers everywhere. But really what we're saying in that is God made the world, God runs the world, and God still is active in history. So that's a principle of Jewish faith is God is active in history. Didn't just set it and forget it like the first cause theory, but is active in history. So, anyway, we have this first cause thing, and that makes it more difficult for paganism to continue on in Greece, which later on sets the stage for the rise of Christianity. But right now, we have this first cause and the tension between the first cause and wisdom and intellect pulling against this advanced form of paganism allows for society, allows the enjoyment and the pleasures of everything physical. So, but there is a tension between the intellectual and philosophic truths that they are discovering or contemplating and this philosophy, but somehow for a while it kind of works nicely in the Greek kingdom. All right, so now we have this, that's pretty clear, right, that you have kind of these dual things happening. All right, so now we have, now we get up to Philip of Macedon. This is in the year 370. So we have, before he comes on the scene, as I said, the Greek empire is divided into these little city-states that are constantly fighting against each other. In order to win, I think I remember who it was, maybe it was the Spartans and the Athenians. So the Athenians had a navy, the Spartans are landlocked, right? So they don't have a navy. They call upon the Persians to come in and help them win in this civil war between them because the Persians have an army. Right, so the Jews now are living in the land of Israel under benevolent Persian rule, right? That's what we were up to last time. Things are working out nicely. The Persians, after the story of Esther, have let the Jews go back and reestablish their temple, and they are basically a faithful and unbothered vassal of the Persian Empire at this point. They're basically living independently. So the Persians are still a strong empire. The Greeks are fighting amongst themselves. The Spartans invite the Persians to come in and help them overcome the Athenians. They do. They win, but now the Persians are in Greece. The Greeks hate the Persians, and there's all kinds of struggling about that. Meanwhile, Philip of Macedonia arises. Now, apparently Macedonia is a Balkan state. And so the Macedonians are looked upon by the Athenians and the Spartans, the more advanced ones, the thinkers, as backwater hicks. But Philip of Macedonia has grand empires in his mind. And he decides he's going to conquer Greece, unify the rule, kick out the Persians, and take over the world. And that's his plan. And somehow he starts to be successful with that. He does manage to unite the Greek kingdom. He does manage to kick out the Persians. And then his armies, or his unified armies, troop through the world a little bit and disassemble the Persian Empire and defeat the Persian armies at Constantinople, whatever it was called at the time. So basically he does defeat them. Meanwhile, for whatever reason, he does not take God's plans into account, and God decides he should die young. So he does. He dies right there before he's unified the world. So he has unified the Greeks. He has kicked the Persians out of Greece. And he has defeated the Persian army and kind of disassembled the Persian kingdom, but he's left chaos. He wasn't yet able to bring it together. Fortunately, he has a son. Right? So his son, he knows he's seen as a backwater hick. And he wants, of course, his son to have the best advantage, so he hires the best tutor for him, Aristotle, who comes and tutors his son and teaches him important philosophy so that his son will be groomed to take over. He has to take over as a teen. However, he is groomed properly, taught well, and capable. In fact, he humbly calls himself Alexander the Great. Right? So here he is a teenager. And he's now inheriting his father's vision for taking over the entire world. And he does. He takes over the entire civilized world. So as a teenager, I mean, he's able to understand how war works. He's been tutored well in philosophy and whatever else he got from his father. And he's a ruthless unifier, in a way, bringing the world together. So, of course, he's out in the world, in his kingdom, looking from the north to the south, and what lies right in the middle of the northern civilized world and the southern civilized world, but?
Israel.
Right. Israel's amazingly strategically placed. You know the story, you know Moses had a stutter, right? He had a speech impediment. Mm-hmm. Not really a stutter, but for the joke it works. He had a speech impediment. So God says, Moses, what land do you want? I'm going to free the Jews. I'll bring them to any place you want. And Moses says, and Hashem says, and God says, Canaan, it's yours. And he says, Canada. So, meanwhile, we got Canaan. But why did we get Canaan? What is special about that land? If you look at a map, and I wish I would have brought a map, but everybody can sort of imagine, you've got, you've got Africa and Egypt below. You've got the Arabian Peninsula and Persia and I should turn around just so you can see, but whatever. You'll figure it out. You've got the Persian Empire to the west. You've got the sea to the east. And you've got Lebanon and Syria and Turkey and Greece all to the north, right? So Israel is exactly in the middle, really, of three continents and the sea, right? So every culture of the known world at the time has to pass through Israel to get anywhere. So if the Jews' role in the world is to be a light unto the nations, to really conquer the world by thought, by education, by philosophy, then that's the perfect piece of land for us. We have to be right there. That is, in a way, the center of the world. Everybody has to go through, and Israel's information and thought can go to the entire world. It's the center. So that's the piece of land that we have, and that's why we're constantly fought over in all these early wars. So here Alexander the Great is going through his kingdom, unifying, conquering, and he comes, he's about now to head into the land of Israel. And the Jews are petrified because they like the Persians, and they support the Persians, and they're living under the Persians, and it's working out very nicely for them. And the Persians have been defeated, and they are petrified of the coming Greek army and what's going to happen. So hearkening back to our last class, the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, there's one surviving member. Does anybody remember who that is? Test you? Simon the Righteous, Shimon HaTzadik. Right, he's the last surviving member, and he is the Kohen Gadol at the time, the high priest at the time. And he, basically at the time, is kind of he's not the king, but he is the leader of the Jews at the time. So he has to decide. I mean, there's really two options when an invading army comes to your country. You either fight or make a deal. So he realized there's no fighting them. We won't win. You can't do that. So he decides to make a deal. So he's not sure exactly what that's going to be yet. But what he does is he gathers all the wise men and the whole Sanhedrin, the group of 70 sages, which is separate. That's the ruling body of 70, and then there's also the wise men, and then there's also the Kohanim, the priestly class. All of them, led by him, go to the gates of Jerusalem to meet Alexander the Great as he's coming with his armies behind him. And Alexander the Great is a very tall man, and he has a great white horse. Different sources say, but certainly recorded in the Talmud, but he does happen to have a legendary white horse that's extremely large. And he happens to be very large for that time when people were generally shorter. Alexander himself is a large man on a large horse, and he wears a plumed hat. So he even looks taller. So he's very impressive. And he comes up riding on his white horse with his armies behind to the Jews, who are coming out of the city to greet him. We have Shimon HaTzadik there at the head, and Alexander dismounts and bows down to Shimon HaTzadik. And so everybody's wondering, what's going on? He is the ruler of the whole entire civilized world at this point, coming to conquer the land of Israel, and he's getting off his horse and bowing down to the religious leader of the Jews. What is that about? So his disciples, his soldiers, his generals ask him, what are you doing? And he says, every time that before I went into war, I'd have a dream of being victorious in the war, conquering the enemy, but I was always led by an angel that helped me conquer it. And the face of the angel is the face of that man, Shimon HaTzadik. So we bowed down to him. So again, what does that story mean? Could that story be true? It could be true. And it also means that what was happening was Alexander the Great recognized in Shimon HaTzadik, the representative of the Jews, something true. So here you have this man who was tutored by Aristotle in some of the philosophy that he got from Solomon, and now he's coming back to the land of Solomon and the holders of that philosophy, and he's bowing down to it. And he says, I recognize in you a truth. I'm not just going to run over you and conquer you. Let's talk. And so they do. And it's the only time in his conquering journeys that he reacts gently with any nation. And they do reach an accommodation.